You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin college's plans for how to bring back students safely to campus is getting some attention. We'll find out how they hope to do it. First, nearly 20 million Americans were continuing to file unemployment as of last week, and while some businesses have reopened with employees being called back to work, a huge chunk of Americans are still stuck. In an effort to create more jobs in their city, Green Bay has announced plans to spend $136,000 of the $600,000 they received in federal coronavirus aid in order to create something they're calling the Green Bay Conservation Corps. Eric Genrich is the mayor of Green Bay and joins us with the details now. Mayor Genrich, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
And also joining us is Dan Dyshit. He is the director of the Parks, Recreation, and Forestry. Dan, welcome to the show as well.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Mayor, can you give us an idea of how big the impact of the pandemic has been on your city, especially in jobs?
Well, it's been significant. I think the impact that we've felt here in Green Bay is similar to the impact that's been felt around the state of Wisconsin and around the country, you know, double-digit unemployment, millions and millions of people out of work across the country. And so we've been feeling that here in Green Bay. The reason that we've, you know, responded by allocating the community development block grant funds as we have is, you know, to really provide support as quickly as possible to the individuals in our community who are needing help. So the Green Bay Conservation Corps is one aspect of that.
And what are you hearing from residents of Green Bay who are unemployed, either continuing to be unemployed or newly unemployed because of the pandemic?
Yeah, so I know that, you know, there are a lot of folks struggling to navigate the unemployment insurance system, particularly, you know, people in the hospitality industry have been heavily impacted by the coronavirus. And so, you know, just a lot of individuals who are looking for work. I know a lot of young people who have been going to school, either high school or college, during the fall and spring and are looking for employment in the summer, not finding as many opportunities as is traditionally available. So again, you know, trying to meet that need in a modest way, admittedly, with the Conservation Corps. We would love to do a lot more. We'd love to employ, you know, hundreds of individuals, but we're making the most of the federal dollars that have been allocated to us to this point.
Well, I'd like to turn to Dan now. Where did this idea to create a Conservation Corps come from?
Well, the mayor worked very closely with our planning department when they were allocating the funding, and that's where the idea came up from. And so, you know, this is a great opportunity for the city as a whole to benefit and do a lot of projects that normally wouldn't get done without the additional funding and the additional resources of new staff.
And are these projects that will be taken on something you've been hoping to be able to take care of for a while, Dan?
Yeah, so the projects within the Parks Department are projects that are on a wish list, more or less. They're things that need to be done, but we currently don't have the staffing power to do them. So this is a great opportunity to get some capital projects done within the park system.
We're talking right now with Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich and also with Dan Dyshit. He's the director of the Parks and Recreation and Forestry Department at Green Bay. And Mayor, have you been in touch with other mayors around the country who are launching similar projects? Because it seems like this is an idea that is pretty popular.
Yeah, I did. I haven't been in touch with too many folks around the country who are doing similar work, but I did happen to notice there was a New York Times story that touched on the work that we're doing here and also mentioned the work of the city council down in Austin. They're in the process of implementing a similar program. And so I think it's a very good thing, obviously, for local communities to be innovating in their own ways and providing assistance to their own citizens and in unique ways. And my hope, as I've said previously, is that the federal government will sort of pay attention to the way that different cities and communities are using these dollars. And hopefully in the next round of negotiations, which is what we're looking for some additional support for local communities to come out of Washington in response to this pandemic and the economic consequences. You know, we're hoping that they might take a look at a program like this and recognize that if there were additional resources provided to cities like Green Bay, we'd be able to do a heck of a lot more for our citizens.
And Dan, how many people are you thinking you'll be hiring, and how long might those jobs last?
So we're in the process right now of working with our human resources department to get the positions advertised fairly soon. We're just working through the details of the plan right now. And as part of that plan, we'll figure out the details such as how many employees are we going to hire, how many crews are we going to have, and how long would the employment last. So we're still working on those details.
And you mentioned that a lot of the projects that you'll be taking on through this program are ones that you've been hoping to be able to get to that need to be done, but there hasn't been the staff to be able to do it. Can you give us an idea or two of the projects that you're going to be taking on?
Sure. I'll kind of focus a little bit on the wildlife sanctuary because there's actually quite a bit of work there that could be done with these employees. So we have several boardwalks in our nature areas in the trails. And these boardwalks were built years ago, and a lot of the boards are starting to rot out, and they're really just in need of replacement. So we have funding set aside to purchase the lumber and the materials, but it takes a considerable amount of staff time to actually do the actual work. So that's one project, along with replacing our floating boardwalk out there, which is in the similar condition as the trail boardwalks. We'd also like to tackle maybe a 4K exploration area. So over at the sanctuary, we have a nature-based 4K program where we've teamed up with the Green Bay School District and UWGB to offer a 4K nature-based hands-on program. So we'd like to construct a dedicated area for the students to go out and do some hands-on learning. But it wouldn't be open to the general public. This would be an area just for a classroom, an outdoor classroom area. In addition, you know, outside of the wildlife sanctuary, we have a lot of trails in the Baird Creek Greenway that are bike trails. Those bike trails, for the most part, are maintained by volunteers. And so with a little bit of assistance from this program, we can turn a good trail system into a very good trail system by putting some labor into it. So those are just a few potential projects that we're looking at. But obviously, there's always a lot of landscape projects you could do throughout the entire park system. You know, we're even looking at projects such as building open shelters, rentable open shelters within the parks. So there's a lot of possibilities, and we have a pretty lengthy list, and it's just kind of going down the priorities and picking the ones that are most important.
Mayor Genrich, it sounds like a lot of these projects will obviously be providing employment for people who are currently without a job, but it also sounds like a lot of them will have a lasting impact for the whole Green Bay community. Was that part of your goal here?
Yeah, that's certainly the hope. I think it's sort of obvious that we've been inspired by, you know, some of the New Deal programs, PA and the CCC. And, you know, you still go around our community here in Northeast Wisconsin and around the state generally and see those plaques and understand the lasting impact of the jobs programs that existed during the Great Depression. And so, yes, I think, you know, our hope is that the projects that are accomplished by this group of individuals will be long lasting and have an immediate impact on this community, but will be, you know, a lasting testament to the investment that we made.
And Dan, when will these jobs be available and how can people apply?
Well, I don't have a timeline as far as when they'll be available. We were working through the plans and the details right now. But really, people should just continue to look at the city webpage in our human resources main page, because that's where we list all of our positions.
And Mayor Genrich, before we let you go, you said that you're devoting $136,000 to this. That leaves about a little over $400,000 left of that pot of federal money that's coming to Green Bay. What are some of your plans for the rest of that money?
Yeah, so we have dedicated $80,000 to homelessness relief efforts, and $100,000 for our revolving loan fund, another 100,000 for frontline relief for workers that have been directly impacted or displaced, $100,000 for our business improvement districts who serve our downtown businesses, which unfortunately have been struggling through this difficult period, and then some just administrative costs that cover the the work of city employees on the community development block grant program. But that's the sampling that we chose, and the intent was really to do as much as we possibly could with a limited amount of funding.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Eric Genrich is the mayor of Green Bay, Wisconsin. We also spoke with Dan Discheit. He's the director of Parks, Recreation, and Forestry for the city of Green Bay. They joined us to talk about the city's plans to create a Green Bay Conservation Corps. It's a program that would create jobs for currently unemployed residents. Coming up, Beloit College in southern Wisconsin has a unique plan for how to balance safety and the on-campus experience this fall. Their provost will give us the details. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, it's our weekly roundup of the top news out of Washington, including the latest on a developing story about alleged Russian bounties for U.S. and allied soldiers in Afghanistan. First, many colleges and universities are working hard to balance the health and safety of their students, faculty, and staff with the desire to return to campus in the fall. Beloit College in southern Wisconsin created what it's calling the Beloit Action Plan, and it's getting attention from other colleges struggling with similar issues. Eric Boynton is provost and dean of Beloit College. Previously, he was a professor of philosophy and religious studies at Allegheny College, where he also served as the director of interdisciplinary studies, director of the honors program, and chair of black studies. Provost Boynton, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, too.
So tell us what your specific goals were in crafting the Beloit Action Plan. What exactly are you trying to achieve?
Sure. So the Beloit Action Plan has five components to it. The first component is what we're calling the MODS plan, which is the way in which we're delivering our curriculum that's attracting quite a bit of attention nationwide. And the MODS plan is splitting up the semester into 2 7.5-week MODS instead of a 15-week semester. So each student will take 2 courses per MOD. And so over the space of a semester, they'll complete the full load of 4 classes, but they'll do it in these 2 class increments. And the reason we developed this idea was to maximize flexibility, particularly in the time of COVID, and minimize disruption. So only 2 classes are ever affected if we move off campus. There is a distinct and natural hinge point in the semester where we can either bring people to campus or move people off campus. It provides for some interesting flexibility in the calendar. If we need to move a whole mod into the spring, that's a possibility as well. So it just provides this kind of flexibility. The other parts of the Beloit Action Plan involve innovation around the curriculum and career preparation and also pricing. So No increase for current students. And for entering first-year students this year, we instituted a Midwest tuition match. So the neighboring 6 states would accept the flagship tuition price for price at Beloit.
And I want to get back to some of those other components, but I want to talk a little bit more about the academic instruction part of it. My understanding too is that in this time of COVID and the coronavirus, we are trying to limit how many people are in a single place at the same time. It sounds like with the MODS approach that there will be fewer times in a week, for instance, that one single student would actually need to be on campus or in a particular building, things like that. Is that part of the plan?
That's part of the plan. So if you think about it, it simplifies the class schedule immensely. So it's essentially morning classes and afternoon classes. So part of of what you need to navigate is the density, and that's the students traveling in and outside of spaces, in and outside the different classrooms. And so what we've done is minimize that passing, and so there's just morning courses and afternoon courses. there's timed in the clean spaces. There is a minimal contact between students passing each other through these classroom environments. And, of course, like every college, we're also thinking very creatively about how to deliver our curriculum in the fall. And so, you know, it's not going to be either online or face-to-face. It's going to be some kind of hybrid situation mm-hmm. that most people are planning for. And so that helps, again, with density. So there'll be flipped classrooms, for instance, where students will watch a lecture online, and then a subset of each class might come in for a recitation period. There's also ways in which courses can be divided up. You know, 1 week, you know, a portion of students will be online. That week, that portion will be in class. And so there's interesting ways to work with density, make sure that we're conducting instruction in as safe and sensible a manner as possible.
And what kind of feedback are you getting from faculty? Obviously, they have concerns to faculty, staff, and students themselves.
Sure. So one of the things we've done is we realized that not all faculty, staff, and students will be able to be on campus in the fall. And we realized that early on. I mean, for instance, there's certain faculty who shouldn't come to campus for various reasons. Those faculty will teach fully online courses. And that works because there will be certain students who won't be able to come to campus, either due to health reasons or international students who may not be able to get visas. Those are still our students, and so we need to find a way to make sure that they progress towards a degree. And so the overlap of online courses delivered by our faculty with the student population that can't make it to campus and enables us to continue to meet our educational mission. And then if there are staff who can conduct their work remotely, then we should go ahead and encourage that during this time of COVID. This is just a way of thinking smartly about the situation we find ourselves in, at the same time remaining absolutely focused on the student experience and our educational mission.
We're talking right now with Eric Boynton. He's Provost and Dean of Beloit College in Southern Wisconsin, and he is explaining the components of what they are calling the Beloit Action Plan, which is their plan to bring students and faculty back to campus, more or less, in a safe and healthy way. One of the issues, of course, for any college experience for students, especially in their families, is housing. That has to be a big concern. What are you thinking in the way of housing?
Sure. So, you know, this issue is really different depending on what institution, which educational institution you're thinking of. So at a place like Beloit, that has a really large campus for a small amount of student population, we're able to essentially allow singles, those students who want to live in singles, we're going to be able to do that. And so we can really spread the population across various dorms. We don't have a dorm that's 10 stories tall. These are buildings spread out around campus. And so there's interesting ways in which we can house our students and also treat this issue of density well. The dorms will, require extra cleaning. We're thinking about the ways in which students outside of the dorms come together for activities in careful ways. Of course, eating is another component of this, how we will have windows of meal times for students to be able to go to and have a hot meal in the commons, but also be able to social distance during meal times, as well as grab and go. Meal options. So, yes, we've been thinking through all the ways in which we need to live on campus in smart, sensible ways. That aspect of the plan will actually come out tomorrow in greater detail on the website. And so we're looking forward to sharing the details of those kinds of planning with our community.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation the Midwest Flagship Match Tuition Program, which will keep tuition hopefully affordable for the majority of students. And I also saw in reading through the plan that you're negotiating new financial aid packages, understanding that there are a lot of students whose families are in a very different financial situation mm-hmm. than they might have been even just 3 or 6 months ago. What are you looking at to plug those holes?
Sure. So we have a form online, in which students and parents can update their information that allows us to make the original package, financial packages. They can update their information, and that goes to our financial aid office, and we can reevaluate the kind of offer that we should offer to that student. And so, yeah, that's an ongoing recognition that this maximizing the flexibility and minimizing disruption that we're involved in. And the things that are in our control are the way in which we deliver the curriculum. And one of the things that's in our control is our pricing, somewhat of the education. And so we need to be cognizant of the way in which COVID has had profound effect on the economy and, of course, our students and parents' financial ability to pay. And so that's part of the Blight Action Plan, is that recognition that we need, especially at this time, to factor in the way in which COVID is really affecting their families.
And very briefly, because we're almost out of time, how will you measure success of the plan?
Success of the plan is that we will, by and large, meet our educational mission, have students on campus, and our students will progress towards graduation in the rich, transformative educational environment that we've always sought to supply at Bloie College. So I think it's the same rubrics you might use in a normal time. We need to be able to meet our educational mission.
Well, Provost Boynton, thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck with the plan.
Thank you very much, Judith.
Eric Boynton is Provost and Dean of Beloit College. He was with us today to share the Beloit Action Plan, which is their approach to bringing students, faculty, and staff back to campus this fall in a way that protects their health and safety. Coming up after the news, we look at the latest push for statehood for the District of Columbia and other top Washington stories. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's K-12 students have gotten more diverse over the last decade, but the percentage of teachers of color in public schools hasn't kept pace. We'll look at the numbers and talk about why they matter for kids. First, it's time for our weekly roundup of top stories from the nation's capital. President Trump and the intelligence and defense agencies of his administration are making a variety of statements in response to explosive reporting about the possibility of Russian bounties on the lives of American and allied soldiers in Afghanistan. We'll also look at some of the history of the Fraternal Order of Police's influence in Washington, and what is the capital expecting for this weekend's observance of the 4th of July. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the twists and turns of the story of alleged Russian bounties? What would you like to have clarified? And what do you think this president or any president should or should not be briefed on from an intelligence standpoint? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joining us this week is Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's lead off with this story that sounds something out of a political thriller, the Russian bounties. Different intelligence agencies, the Defense Department, Republicans and Democrats are all saying slightly different things about this alleged intelligence. Who has control of the narrative right now?
Well, if you listen to the Trump administration, or I should say the White House and President Trump himself, what's going on is that Trump didn't know anything about this. And if he did know anything about this, it's a hoax. That is what the administration is trying to get out there, but I don't think that they are winning that. They have invited members of Congress to the White House to try to make clear that this intelligence isn't as clear-cut as it seems, that there are some discrepancies, there was some disagreement about how solid it was. You know, I think that is that's an attempt to cover up the fact that the president didn't pay attention to the daily briefing he received in February. And this is a written document that presidents receive, that most presidents read, but President Trump doesn't, clearly.
And he has said that himself.
Right. He said this. And so, you know, they're trying to cover up the fact that this information, this important information, was put in front of him and he didn't read it and he didn't notice it. And so they're saying, look, the intelligence was never as clear as it seems, and they're trying to muddy the waters a little bit. But you have more news reports coming out that are more and more embarrassing for the president. You have some Republicans saying, like, look, this is a serious deal. We need to get to the bottom of this. That's not what you're hearing Trump say at all. You would think that you would be hearing him say, you know, even if there are some questions, I want to know more, and this is outrageous.
And I want to get back to that Republican response, but I do want to look a little bit at the Democrats. I believe, was it 8 Democrats were invited to the White House for a briefing yesterday? They've been calling for a briefing of the entire House of Representatives, but they were offered 8. But the briefing was not from military or intelligence representatives. They were really administration kind of office of the president type people. Instead, what does that say to us?
Right. This is a PR exercise. They're trying to do damage control rather than, once again, get to the bottom of this. If the White House were really concerned about it, you would see, I think, more of a press for, you know, actual investigations and actual, you know, actual fact gathering. But the president himself has long been skeptical of the intelligence agency. He thinks that, you know, there's this deep state conspiracy to embarrass him. And he has called out the intelligence agency, you know, often around the Russia impeachment matter with Ukraine. And so he has long been skeptical of the intelligence agency, which you're seeing coming out in this.
And let's talk about the Republicans. It has been the rare Republican on the rare instance that has gone against the Trump administration's kind of marching orders. What, if any, pushback are we seeing from members of the president's own party?
Well, I will say that a lot of Republicans are obviously backing the president up, as they usually do, saying that, you know, intelligence agencies often don't agree with each other. The initial reports were false. But you are seeing, you know, national security and being tough on Russia is something where Republicans have often tried to distinguish themselves, especially from Democrats. And so you are seeing Republicans here and there saying, like, you know, I'm concerned about what I'm hearing. I would like to know more about this. But the pushback, of course, has been fairly light because they're afraid of criticizing the president too much.
There are more developments coming out. I was going to say daily, but really it's probably closer to hourly. One of the latest is that there are, you know, they say follow the money. There is money, that large amounts of money that were transferred from basically the Russian security agency to known Taliban representatives. That's one of the most recent pieces of news. What, if anything, is going to ensure that this is an issue that actually gets looked at and gets taken seriously by members of both parties?
Well, I think that you'll see Democrats continuing to bring this up. You know, they control the House. They can call for investigations. Like you said, that there are news reports that continue to come out about this frequently, showing that, you know, this wasn't just a rogue intelligence analyst slipping something into the president's briefing. You know, that's not how this happened. Intelligence analysts had actual verifiable information that led them to believe that this is what was going on. And I think that you'll see more and more evidence come out about this, as perhaps intelligence analysts are upset that what they were finding wasn't being taken more seriously. And you could, of course, have more families of service members speak out as well, that they want answers.
We're about 4 months out from the 2020 presidential election, which in some ways seems like a long time away, and in other ways it seems like a blink of an eye. Do you see this issue as being one that, that carries over and influences that election?
If being honest, probably not. I think that a lot of people right now are not focused on foreign policy because we are in the middle of a pandemic still. And I think that, you know, the economy, people's health and healthcare are still on the front of voters' minds. And rarely does national security and foreign policy dominate an election. So, you know, I think that this further gives ammunition to his critics, Trump's critics, and people who stand by him are more likely to believe him. So I think we're going to still hear more about the coronavirus, you know, as in the run up to November, unless something else, you know, major happens. And with the way this year is going, who knows?
It is a new month after all. We're ready for a new crisis, right? We are talking right now with Amanda Turco, Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post, taking a look at some of the biggest news stories out of the nation's capital this week. And Amanda, you wrote a very extensive article about the Fraternal Order of Police and their influence in the nation's capital. Police reform certainly is a huge issue on the most local of levels and on a national level. I definitely want to talk about the Fraternal Order of Police, but let's first touch on what is going on in Congress with police reform bills, because there seemed to be quite a bit of momentum and then it came to a screeching halt.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there's not a lot going on now. There was for a little while. Both the Senate and the House tried to pass legislation. And because the Senate is controlled by Republicans and the House is controlled by Democrats, neither chamber really liked the other's bill. And so in the Senate, you had Senator Tim Scott, who's the only Black senator in the Republican Party, lead the way on a piece of legislation that Democrats said didn't go far enough. It didn't ban the use of chokeholds and no-knock warrants by police. And it also, notably, did not get rid of this concept called qualified immunity, which basically makes it impossible to sue police for misconduct. And it really shields police. And it's something that's very important. We were talking about the Fraternal Order of Police, which is basically the largest police union in the country. It's very important to police unions. And it's very something that most Republicans want to protect as well. The House legislation, which was led by Congresswoman Karen Bass, who's head of the Congressional Black Caucus, did go farther. It did ban all of those things. It did get rid of qualified immunity. And Republicans have said in the Senate that they're just not going to take it up. And so basically, it seems like, you know, I think there will be a few more attempts to come up with legislation, but it doesn't seem like police reform is really going to go anywhere this session.
Well, and it's interesting because in your piece, you talk about how for many, many years, it was very dangerous politically to not be seen as pro-police, pro-law enforcement, and that it could really affect your chances of being reelected, for instance, to whatever post you're holding. In this moment that we are living, that seems like it's not the given it used to be. But there is still this very powerful lobbying group called the Fraternal Order of Police. Can you tell us briefly what kind of power they wielded, say 2019 and before, since 2020 has been a very different year?
Yeah, I mean, they have allies on both sides, obviously. So they're very allied now with Donald Trump, and they have generally endorsed Republicans for president, with the exception of Bill Clinton. But, you know, they do have, you know, Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont is one of their biggest champions on Capitol Hill. But, you know, Democrats and Republicans, you know, especially at the local level, if you're running for mayor or something like that, you want the endorsement of police unions. You want to be seen as someone who's going to, you know, hold up law and order, who is on the side of police. I think now a lot more candidates are questioning that. And I've talked to Democratic strategists who are saying that their candidates are looking at whether they really want those endorsements. If they get the endorsement of a police union, are they going to tout it in a press release? Are they going to go seeking out those endorsements? That's not as obvious an answer as it used to be. And so the Fraternal Order of Police, you know, basically they could scare politicians into, you know, if you don't support what we're on, we're going to say you're anti-police. And that seemed to be scary enough for politicians in the past, whether or not it was a real threat, that they often went along with what the Fraternal Order of Police wanted. And like you said, I think now people are starting to question that more and are pushing back a little bit, saying we want to see more reform. And the FOP and these other police unions are often standing in the way of that.
I found it really interesting in your very lengthy piece about the Fraternal Order of Police that you likened their stances and the way they approach lobbying as very similar to that of the NRA, in that, you know, it's very much a, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And so they have historically been extremely resistant to any kind of reforms because they see it as such a slippery slope. Do you get any sense from the Fraternal Order of Police that they might see some advantage in softening some of their stances and at least giving the impression that they're willing to work on these issues?
They're giving the impression that they are, yes. you know, they have already said that they're open to banning chokeholds. But that seems to be something that's sort of easy for them to give up because a lot of a lot of codes of conduct already ban chokeholds. Some law enforcement office organizations don't, but for the most part, that's already something that's seen as taboo. So they can say, yeah, you know, we're against that. They said, came out very, very hard and said, we oppose getting rid of qualified immunity. We don't like creating a national registry, for example, of police officers so that you can see their misconduct records everywhere, no matter where you are. And that prevents hiring a bad cop, you know, someone who is a bad cop in one department, and hiring them in another state, for example. They're against that. So I think they are doing things that make it look like they're trying to be sort of good cooperative players, but they're still standing firm. And, you know, like the NRA, they represent the extreme. They tend to be more conservative. Their organization is very, at the top, very heavily white male. And there are other police organizations that represent more officers of color who don't take such an extreme hardline stand as the FOP and some of these other unions.
We're talking with HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle about some of the biggest stories out of the nation's capital this week. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the influence of police unions as a special interest group in Washington? Would you judge a politician on whether they had a favorable or unfavorable mark from one of those groups? And we want to hear what you would like to see Congress do about police reform. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after a short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our talk now about the week in Washington news with HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle. And Amanda, I want to turn to the topic of Washington, D.C. statehood. Statehood and the ability to end the period of, quote, taxation without representation has long been just a dream for residents of the District of Columbia. But the House of Representatives actually approved a bill granting it, but there are a lot of obstacles. Take us through what the process is.
Right. So, I mean, it's the first time that the House in the 219-year history of Washington, D.C., it's the first time that either chamber of Congress has ever approved D.C. becoming a state. And it's not going to go anywhere because you have President Trump in office. He is not going in the White House. He's not going to sign this. He's made that very clear. And he's made clear it's political because D.C. is very, very Democratic, and he doesn't want to give he doesn't want more Democrats in Congress. And then you have the Senate, which is obviously also controlled by Republicans. So for now, it's not going anywhere. And it really hinges on Democrats retaking control of the White House and the Senate in the next Congress in order to get this going and obviously to retain control in the House. And you probably need a filibuster proof majority. So 60 Democratic senators in the Senate. So it has a very steep climb. But for a lot of people, in D.C., that this was symbolic, and this was shown, you know, this sort of showed how far the Democratic Party has moved over time. You know, there was a time when not even all Democrats supported this because you had a lot of Southern Democrats. And the politics of not giving D.C., you know, representation in Congress was really racist, to be quite honest. And it was because a lot of freed blacks after slavery came to the district. The population was heavily African-American, and that spurred the federal government to get rid of the city's elected government. And so, you know, the reason that D.C. doesn't have representation has a pretty ugly past.
Let's take a listen to Democratic Representative Maxine Waters speaking in support of the bill.
Washington, D.C. is the home to more Americans than two states, and more than 46% of its 700,000 residents are black. Make no mistake, race underlies every argument against D.C. statehood, and denying its citizen equal participation and representation is a racial, democratic, and economic injustice we cannot tolerate.
So, Amanda, very much what you were saying, and what I think is especially important is that this is happening now. As you said, it's the first time that there's been a positive vote on this. And given the backdrop of Black Lives Matter, of the violence that is going on and being protested against, it seems like there is a very clear connection between the two.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, interest in this was revived when Trump sent federal forces into the streets of D.C. during the protests. He couldn't do that in other states because the governors control the National Guard. But in D.C., he was allowed to do that. And so that, you know, obviously made a lot of people in D.C. upset. And people started, you know, once again, talking about statehood. And, you know, it's, you know, The Congress and has often stepped in D.C.'s affairs, you know, beyond just Trump now sending federal forces in. You know, they have tried to they blocked laws passed by D.C.'s elected government, blocking abortion funds in the 80s, domestic partnership benefits for same sex couples in 1992, clean needle exchanges in 96, the legalization of marijuana in 2014. And every time D.C. passes some major legislation affecting the city, you have Congress. You know, often stepping in, especially when it's controlled by Republicans, stepping in and trying to stop it, even though, you know, these lawmakers don't live here and don't, you know, aren't represented by these lawmakers.
Well, in an interesting kind of addition to that issue, the 4th of July is this weekend. Obviously, as the nation's capital, there are often huge festivities. And last year, President Trump held what was seen as a rally of sorts in Washington, D.C. There's a lot going on right now that makes 2020 different, not least of which is the pandemic. What are we expecting in terms of the 4th of July events in the capital this year?
Well, the D.C. mayor, Muriel Bowser, who is a Democrat, canceled the 4th of July parade. There will be fireworks still. Trump and the First Lady will still be doing, you know, sort of a little speech rally type thing from the White House. And the National Mall will be open if people do want to go down and see fireworks. The mayor is advising people to stay home, to not come out, you know, to watch the fireworks from their house or from somewhere at a safe distance, while the White House and the president are, you know, say they want a repeat of years past. They want people down there. You know, they want it to be a show of support for the president, basically. You know, I don't know what we're going to see yet. I don't think it will be like years past, especially if people are aware that Trump wants them to come out, especially because D.C. residents aren't super fond of Trump because it is such a Democratic city. But the question is, will people be coming in from other cities? D.C. typically attracts a big national crowd on the 4th of July. And I don't know how many people will be traveling here with, you know, the coronavirus spike in other parts of the country and all the travel sort of hesitations people have.
Well, Amanda, always a pleasure to talk with you and to have you with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That's Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. We talked with her about some of the top stories coming out of Washington this week that included the efforts in both the Senate and the House to have police reform legislation that would be agreeable to both parties. We also talked about the developments in the story about bounties allegedly being paid by Russia to the Taliban to kill U.S. and allied forces. And we also talked about the issue of D.C. statehood, what it would give those residents, and why there would be opposition from Republicans in the Senate and also the Trump administration itself. It's the first day of July. It's a new month, and I'm betting that some of you started the day by saying rabbit or rabbit, rabbit or rabbit, 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 or maybe even white rabbit. Well, I first encountered that good luck superstition when I had a roommate from New Zealand. That makes sense because it seems like the custom may have originated in England and then spread to its territories around the world. In the U.S., it got its strongest foothold in New England. Well, prominent rabbit, rabbit sayers include President Franklin Roosevelt and public radio word maven Martha Barnett. Here she is talking about it on Weekend Edition Sunday a few years ago.
I resolve to do that, but then I usually forget. There are other people who are much better at that. Simon Winchester, the writer, went for 696 months before he forgot to say white rabbits one day. If you forget at the end of the day, you can say black rabbit right before you go to sleep, or you can say tibber tibber.
Tibber tibber?
It's rabbit spelled backwards.
Well, my friend Marika is a committed rabbit rabbiter and told me that she doesn't think it's a zero-sum deal and that there's enough good fortune to go around for everyone, so she invites family and friends to say it too. Our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, is also an aficionado of rabbit rabbit. Well, I did not say it first thing this morning, so if I remember, I might get a tibber tibber in before bed. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.